Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect brings to you today an archival interview several years ago with Dr. Gary Block, a family physician at St. Michael's Hospital, who argues that the special diet then was a partial remedy for inadequate social assistance rates. And today, the inadequacy of social assistance rates has doubled. The amount received for social assistance has steadily declined. For 20 years, not the 10 discussed in the interview. And the percentage loss is approaching the incalculable. With that, I'll introduce you to Dr. Gary Block.
We welcome to the show Dr. Gary Block, a family physician at St. Michael's Hospital and at Seton House Shelter in Toronto. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Gary, I understand you've made some fairly aggressive response to the provincial government's attempt to restrict access to the special diet program. For someone who isn't familiar with this issue, can you make a brief wrap-up of the progress to date?
Sure. Since about February of this year, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty has been conducting a campaign to give people on social assistance, people on Ontario Works, Ontario Disability Support, access to what's known as a special diet supplement.
Right.
Which is an extra amount of money provided for under welfare legislation by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And accessible to people on assistance as long as they are approved for the supplement by a healthcare provider. And the kind of new development, those two new developments, first of all, just increased awareness amongst recipients about the supplement.
Right.
And second of all, that we have been signing these forms, signing special diet application forms for people to receive the full supplement of $250 a month. For anyone on social assistance on the basis they're living in significant poverty.
Yeah.
And we've basically stated, and it's sort of a known fact, that poverty is the largest risk factor for ill health.
Right.
And based on that justification, we're saying that people with a diagnosis of poverty should receive the full special diet supplement.
In other words, they don't get enough money to buy the right food to eat.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or any other basic, or I mean, they basically don't get enough money to cover their basic necessities of life.
So essential necessities of life. And so the diet allowance would alleviate one of those shortages.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the diet allowance essentially makes up for the drop in welfare that's occurred over the past 10 years.
Yeah. And how high do you assess that to be? We've said this many times, but let's say it again.
Yeah, the overall drop in real terms is about 40%.
Right.
So it's very significant.
So okay. You know,
and that's not to say that welfare was at an adequate rate 10 years ago.
That's true.
But it's much lower now than it was then.
So you're talking about before the 21% drop or after?
I'm talking about the 21% drop, and since then,
and inflation.
The rest of the drop, yes, is effectively a drop because of inflation.
Okay. So inflation's created almost another 20% drop.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's quite stunning when you think about the effect that has on people and, you know, families living in poverty.
Right.
It's huge.
And you're working with OCAP on this?
Yep.
What had OCAP done, and what have you done now in response to the province's response? It sounds a little confusing. Let me ask that question again. What have OCAP done? How has the province responded, and how are you and OCAP dealing with that?
Sure. Well, the province responded by changing the forms that we're able to use. So essentially changing the application process for the special diet supplement.
Five or six times, I heard.
Well, there were five or six times, yeah. And most of the initial changes were actually reversed by the province because they realized they were untenable for a number of reasons. But after consultation with the Ontario Medical Association, the province came out with a radically new application process and a new form, which has essentially shut down our ability to prescribe this supplement.
Right. Well, it's a very prescriptive form, isn't it? In the sense that you can't prescribe the supplement, the form almost prescribes who can receive it and who can't.
Well, that's right.
And it's a very narrow form.
That's right. And the change has been, I mean, what there was previously was a form which listed a number of diets that we could prescribe for people and just certify that they had a medical condition that required those diets.
Right.
We didn't have to state what that medical condition was. We could make the assessment that they required those diets. Yes, essentially a medical assessment allowing the healthcare provider who is filling the form to make that assessment, determine what the client needs.
Right.
The new forms actually require us to state what a client's medical conditions are. And there's no provision on there for saying what diets they need or what type of supplement they need.
So someone else makes the decision about what diet or supplement they need.
That's right. So it's put in the hand of that client's social services worker to match up their condition with an amount of supplements, a special diet supplement.
Really? So it's literally made by the social services agency?
It's literally made by the social services agency.
Yeah. Wow.
Exactly.
So you might find lenient social service agencies who take a broad interpretation, and you might find social service agencies who want to help, but they're just incapacitated because you don't have an illness on the form.
Well, actually, no, they're quite restricted as well. I mean, every condition is matched up with a very specific amount of money that they're allowed to give for it.
And if you don't have such a condition, there's no money matched
up. There's no money matched up to it.
I see.
And it doesn't give us the latitude to prescribe the supplement for any condition that's not on the form. And, of course, poverty is not on that form.
Of course.
Even though I 100% believe it should be.
Right.
I mean, again, it's the largest risk factor for ill health.
Right.
And the amounts of money that almost anyone who's receiving the supplement would be eligible for has dropped dramatically. I mean, I don't have exact figures for you. I mean, we haven't done a study on this yet, but I would guess that for most people, the amount will drop by somewhere around 75 to 90%.
Right.
Many of the conditions are now worth around $10 to $20
right.
per condition, whereas people previously were receiving around $250 of a supplement.
Your voice, I hate to say this, your voice drops from a numerical register of 17 to 45 on my form, and it'll be, I don't have software installed to do compression on that order, except manually over 6 or 7 hours.
Oh.
So if it could play in a narrower range, it would be ready for the compressor that we use when we broadcast, too.
I will do my best.
Well, I don't want a monotone, but 45 to 75 is a hell of a range.
Fair enough.
That's okay.
Just the way I talk, what can I say?
No, that's okay, yeah. Well, it'll be more engaging because of it.
Sure. Do you want me to repeat anything, or...?
I'm trying to get back to where we were. You were saying special diet supplements for people who are now receiving them will drop from 75 to 90%.
That's correct, which is a devastating drop for someone living in poverty. I mean, if you can imagine a family of, you know, three children and a single parent who might have been receiving a supplement of $1,000 in the past, and that supplement may now go down to less than $100.
Oh, I never thought of that. All the for every child gets the supplement, yeah?
Absolutely. And many people were surviving, literally surviving off of that supplement.
Yeah.
And this will be devastating. And this is, I mean, nothing short of a welfare cut from a government that pledged to reverse the cuts in welfare that were brought in by the Conservatives.
And hasn't done so.
And has not done so.
I see.
Absolutely. So in terms of our response to this, I mean, it's been on a number of levels, but the most... I mean, from the political level and in lobbying the government and the Ontario Medical Association to the sort of broad political level, I mean, there was a large rally a couple of weekends ago organized by OCAP.
At Queen's Park, yeah.
It was actually at Nathan Phillips Square, and they walked up to Sandra Cupertello's residence in Toronto.
Oh.
She's the Minister of Community and Social Services.
Right.
But the most recent response has been to file a privacy complaint with the Information and Privacy Commissioner of Ontario.
Right.
And the grounds for this is the fact that we now have to reveal a client's medical conditions, health
yes.
conditions to their social services worker.
And this not only includes embarrassing enough conditions like poverty, but this can include HIV/AIDS.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's very explicitly stated on the form, and I don't in any way think that's appropriate.
You mean that's one of the conditions that they've identified on the form?
Yes,
I
exactly.
See. And then a social service worker has to assess someone who has AIDS.
Well, yes. I mean, and they always have had to assess people with AIDS or with HIV, but they've never had to, they never had the right to know that information. In fact, I don't think they have the right now, but this form forces a client to reveal that information.
Yeah.
They're sort of, I mean, they're obviously between a rock and a hard place, between revealing their condition to their social services worker and all the potential discrimination and stereotypes that can come along with that, and alternatively, giving up the supplement if they don't wish to reveal that condition, which is, in many cases, their livelihood.
What's the judicial course? Well, maybe we should deal with that question first. it may sound extreme, but at Nuremberg, the argument that I was only following orders didn't cut a lot of ice. How far do we go with social service workers who may be upset about this, but are simply saying, I have to do my job? How far do we go with them? Because it's not their fault, but they're the ones who are implementing it.
Right. I mean, before targeting the frontline social services workers at this point, I'd like to move a little bit upstream, which is what we've done.
Right.
Which is asking the Information and Privacy Commissioner, Anne Kavoukian, to deal directly with the ministry.
All right. That makes sense.
To bring forward this complaint as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I've asked the Information and Privacy Commission to request that the ministry allow us a hiatus, a period of time in which we could use the old forms until this privacy issue is assessed and dealt with.
Oh.
I haven't yet heard back from them on
okay.
that request. But I think that's where we need to turn our efforts first.
Well, we need as many allies as we can get, that's for sure. And if the social frontline service workers don't see us as threatening them, they may identify with the client more closely than with the ministry, who's probably giving them a hard time when people are shocked to have to deal with, you know, below the poverty line, or have to deal with a further cut of as much as $1,000.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And, I mean, this is certainly a directive that's coming from above. And they've been asked to change their practices many times over in the last 6 months.
Who have?
The frontline social services workers.
Yeah.
So I can understand that they might be frustrated with what's going on as well, and that's not where I would target my primary energies at this moment.
As an MD, and particularly a family physician, you must be a little embarrassed by the OMA's consultation with doctors coming to a solution like this? I don't mean personally, but I mean professionally.
Yeah, I am. And I'm speaking about the group of us that's been involved with this on the front lines, were quite upset about the way this process was carried forward.
Yeah.
We did ask the OMA a number of times to be brought to the table, or at least be consulted around the changes to this form.
Right.
And that was a request that was flatly denied.
Yeah.
Which we think was absolutely inappropriate, given the fact that we are the health providers who see this form and who use this form more than any others in the province.
Yeah.
And so, and the OMA basically declared this an emergency situation from their end, claiming that physicians were being threatened by social assistance recipients who were demanding the full $250 a month supplement.
Yeah.
And because of this, they felt it was too emergent a situation to engage in proper consultation.
Yeah.
And so they were left with no choice but to cooperate with the ministry to create this new, very restrictive form that took all power out of the hands of healthcare providers to make the assessments required.
Yeah.
I mean, of course I'm embarrassed by that. I'm embarrassed that they would go ahead and make such a rash decision without thinking about the big picture, and the big picture being that this effectively increases the poverty level of thousands of Ontarians.
Yeah.
And I hope that...
when everything else is out of kilter, too. I mean, the baseline welfare rate is out of order, the housing system is out of order, and now the declaring food off limits, too.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's not as if you're imposing this on people who are otherwise well provided for.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I would like to see the OMA declare its position on poverty and health.
Will they?
I don't know. We will certainly request it. Yeah. I hope so. I mean, as I said many times before, poverty is well recognized as the number one determinant of health. And I think that certainly falls within the scope of the largest and most powerful medical organization in Ontario.
I don't know. It always kind of amazes me, surprises me, I think, is the truth, if people don't realize that by repelling the most disadvantaged at the gates of access to help, that they're only going to encounter them outside where they work, on the streets when they shop, in the corners where they sleep because they can't afford homes, and in the dead of the night when some of them give up and say, you know, and not many of them do, but how many does it take, and say, you know, I'm going to take what I need. I don't understand how people think they can hold them at bay. I mean, it's desperation. They're arguing against the life force. You just can't, you know, it's like trying to dissuade a weed from growing through a crack in the sidewalk. You can't do it.
Sure. You're absolutely, I mean, and there's many arguments for it. I mean, I think we also have a moral duty to provide for those who are disadvantaged in our society. And I think that, you know, Canada has a proud history of declaring itself to be a strong welfare state. And I think we should go with that history. It's one of the things that define us as Canadians.
Yeah.
I also think that it's very short-sighted to be cutting back on things like welfare because it just causes huge costs down the road.
Well, acute care costs, for one.
Yeah.
I guess potentially community policing costs for another. You tell me. I mean, it just every kind of talk about dealing with disabilities and educational shortcomings, and you know, this is the generation who's going to take care of these doctors in their old age. Is going to manage their rules by which their financial portfolios are run.
Right.
And what are they going to say about rich people who don't want to share anything? I don't know. It's hard to put a positive light on this, but I think maybe the most positive light I can put on it is these people are our caretakers tomorrow, whether we like it or believe it or not. They will be the government. Why are we mistreating them? Yeah, it doesn't seem reasonable.
Sure, and I agree with that. I mean, you know, the positive spin I can put on it is one of hope.
Yeah.
Which is hope that the government recognizes that this is an effective cut to welfare.
Yeah.
And will turn around and actually raise welfare rates. You know, we'll actually say...
They keep saying they want to, don't they?
They do, and it was one of their election promises.
So somebody wants to, but it's just they don't seem to hold sway right at the moment.
Well, that's right, and I mean, the next budget is expected sometime in the early new year.
Yeah.
So we can all hold out hope that somewhere in that budget will be a significant increase in welfare rates, and hopefully to the tune of around the 40% that they've dropped.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's something worth keeping in the back of our minds, for sure.
Absolutely.
Take the big picture. In the meantime, what's your hope for this ruling? Do you have a date in mind for when this answer is likely to come down from the Privacy Commissioner? You said it's Anne Kavoukian?
It is Anne Kavoukian. I don't have an exact date. I expect it'll be at least a couple of months.
Yeah.
Especially given that this is taking place over the holiday season.
Yeah.
I don't expect things will move particularly quickly, but I do know that they're treating this as a priority case.
Yeah.
And it actually, just to be clear, is what's called a commissioner-initiated complaint.
All right.
While I sent the initial letter, I am not the primary complainant on this case.
Yes.
But the commissioner has determined this is serious enough that she will carry it forward herself.
And she has the power to.
Oh, yes, and she definitely has the power to.
Okay.
So that gives me hope that this will come to resolution faster than it might otherwise.
Faster, in fact, than the budget, too. So you say a couple of months instead of 3 or 4.
Well, yeah, and again, I don't know exactly. That's what I'm hoping, and I will certainly stay on top of it.
Yeah.
Make sure that they move as fast as possible. We are actually meeting with the OMA on the 20th.
Yeah.
We being a group of concerned physicians.
So they finally agreed to meet with you.
They finally agreed to meet with us after
okay.
the fact.
All right. And this is 5 days before, 4 days before Christmas?
That's right.
All right.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we'll see what they have to say at that meeting.
Right.
We are coming to them with the backing of a number of significant other healthcare organizations in Ontario.
Oh, good.
The Ontario College of Family Physicians has supported us. The Ontario Public Health Association has supported us. The Association of Medical Officers of Health of Ontario supported us. The Registered Nurses Association of Ontario has supported us. And they've all expressed explicit support for our position, which is quite exciting. So really, the OMA is the last holdout.
Good.
In terms of healthcare organizations.
All right.
Yeah, which is fantastic.
Good. Well, I'll try and excise some of the more negative remarks I've made about this, but it just appalls me so much.
Oh.
And try and give this the upbeat, cast that it appears to have, you know, the establishment of the need, the pursuit of the benefit, the rejection of the benefit, and now the challenge to the rejection. It doesn't look too bad from here.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and I appreciate your taking time to tell us about it. I guess people should subscribe to the OCAP newsletter if they want to know more, eh?
That's right. And then go to the OCAP website, ocap.ca.
Okay.
And subscribe there, I believe.
All right.
Well, if not, there's an email address for OCAP there.
All right.
And don't hesitate to call again.
All right, thanks, Gay.
Okay, bye, Jeff.
Bye.
Now let's take a short break before we go into the news. Joe Louis Walker, Witness to the Blues.
Well, I'm hustling
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the articles that we read to you. These are summaries of the articles or condensations, abridgments from the papers that we identify in the broadcast. First up, two shots killed son. Dad says police shooting victim was unarmed. The family of Andrea Shinnery says Hamilton police fired two shots at the 19-year-old at very close range, hitting him in the arm and in the abdomen. Said Rob Chinnery, Andrea's father. They were allowed into Andrea's apartment near Lottridge Street. There was a huge pool of blood there, and it looks like they fired at him from the doorway. The family says special investigators have told him Andrea Shinnery did not have a gun or a knife in his hands when police fired at him. A neighbor reported Andreas began acting strangely that night, shouting loudly about death and police. Later, the neighbor said he heard what sounded like apartment walls being smashed with a heavy object and plaster falling on the uncarpeted floor. Rob Shinnery said there was a large pool of blood approximately in the middle of the tiny apartment between the kitchen and the living room, about 3 meters from the apartment door where he believes his son was standing when he was shot. If they're firing from the doorway, then he wasn't a threat to them. He didn't have a gun or a knife. Andrea Shinnery had been living in the low-rise apartment since August. His family says he was a soft-spoken teen who was a budding hip-hop and rap musician. 2 years ago, they say there was a confrontation between the former Sherwood secondary student and police that led to an arrest, during which he was injured. That by Paul Morse in the Hamilton Spectator. G20 victim seeks criminal investigation. Civil case against cops not taken seriously enough, lawyer says. The lawyers for a woman who is suing police after claiming she was shot twice with rubber bullets while peacefully protesting during the G20 summit are now calling for a criminal investigation into her takedown and arrest. Natalie Gray, in September, sued the Toronto Police Services Board and 10 unidentified officers who were involved in the incident. The statement of defense does not identify any of the officers involved in the suit, and while it claims the force used to detain and arrest Gray was reasonable, it does not provide facts to back that claim. At this stage in a civil suit, it's not required to provide either. Police spokesman Mark Pugash said that the complaints set out in Gray's statement of claim are themselves too vague to be able to identify any of the officers involved in the incident. The Toronto Star was able to identify 3 of the unnamed officers in the suit, the constable who Gray and her lawyers believe shot the rubber bullets that left vibrant, saucer-sized bruises on her arms, and the 2 officers who tackled and arrested her shortly afterward. She was charged with obstructing a peace officer. That charge was dropped, and that by Kate Allen in the Toronto Star. SIU reopens probe of man injured at G20. Mississauga. Ontario's Special Investigations Unit is reopening a probe into injuries suffered by a man who claims he was assaulted by police at Toronto's G20 summit. The SIU investigated the claims of Dorian Barton, but said he could not identify officers involved in his arrest or fully explain how his arm was broken. The agency had ruled there were no reasonable grounds to lay charges, but it now says it is reopening the investigation after receiving pictures of Barton's interaction with officers during the G20 demonstrations. Barton's launched a $250,000 lawsuit against the Toronto Police Services Board and 7 unidentified officers. He alleges he was knocked to the ground by an officer with a riot shield while in the designated protest area at the Ontario Legislature. The allegations have not been proven in court. The SIU investigates reports involving police where there's been death, serious injury, or allegations of sexual assault. That from the Canadian Press via the Hamilton Spectator. And a feature story in today's news. The home care Harold was promised failed to arrive. When Harold Chamberlain was discharged from hospital last May, his son was concerned the 81-year-old was still too fragile to go home. Harold's cancerous bladder and prostate had just been removed, and his urine now collected in a pouch through an opening in his abdomen. Officials at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto eased Ron Chamberlain's worries, assuring him his father was well enough to recuperate at home with the help of visiting nurses and personal support workers. A nurse would be at Harold's home the next morning, they promised. So on the Friday before the Victoria Day weekend, drainage tubes and IV were removed and Harold, a retired TTC mechanic, was discharged. But in the 20 minutes it took to drive from Mount Sinai to the younger Chamberlain's East York home, Harold in the passenger seat of the car became soaked in urine. Ron cleaned his father up and the pair then drove 3 hours north to McTeer, the Muskoka community where Harold, a widower, lived alone. He'd come to Toronto for the operation. The next morning, there was no sign of the visiting nurse. Ron called the North Simcoe Muskoka Community Care Access Center. The nurse who answered had no record of Harold and said there was no chance of a nurse getting to his home for another 4 days. This was the first of many frustrating experiences the Chamberlain family had in trying to get home care in the 8 weeks before Harold died. When asked why Harold didn't get the home care he was promised, Mount Sinai and the CCAC point fingers at each other. Bill Innes, Chief Executive Officer of the North Simcoe Muskoka CCAC, said, whenever a person is going to be discharged from hospital, it's necessary to inform the CCAC, whether it's your local one or a remote one, and it's necessary for them to set up the services and have time to do that. That becomes even more important when they wish to discharge somebody on very short notice to a very remote location on a long weekend. Innes said hospitals sometimes like to free up beds before long weekends, and they send somebody out and make promises to them that are inappropriate. He suggested that Mount Sinai should never have discharged Harold in such a frail state in the first place. Sometimes people are discharged inappropriately from hospital. I will leave it at that, Innes said. Harold stayed at the West Perry Sound Health Center for a month. When he was discharged, he was again assured he would get daily home care services, but in the next 2 weeks he had only 3 visits from a nurse and the same from a personal support worker. Ron said he was dying. He didn't need to be angry. He recalled Harold saying to a community care access official over the phone, "Are you a nurse? Why don't you put down your pen, get in your car, and come out and help me?" Again, Harold's health started failing. He lost so much weight that he couldn't even keep his false teeth in his mouth. This time he went to stay with friends in Midland, where the CCAC supports were better. In the 10 days he was there, he received daily visits from either a nurse or a personal support worker. Harold's health continued to go downhill. He was admitted to Mount Sinai on July 13th and died 6 days later. He might have died even with better home care, but at least he would have had more dignity, his son Ron said. He just needed a little bit of care, but instead he ended up with arguments from the CCAC. When you're in that condition, you don't need that rigmarole. And that from the Toronto Star, second in the series, Begging for Care, by Teresa Boyle, health reporter. Poll finds Ontarians turning against Premier Dad. A poll by Nanos Research found that more Ontarians believe Mr. McGuinty will have a negative impact on the election chances of their local Liberal candidate than he will have a positive effect. A stark change for the face and patriarch of Ontario's Liberal Party for nearly 8 years. The poll of 506 Ontarians, which was conducted over 4 days in late January and early February, also found that only 23% of voters believe that Mr. McGuinty would make the best premier, positioning him 9 percentage points behind Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak. Experts attributed the drop in Mr. McGuinty's support to a number of factors. Mr. McGuinty has been bludgeoned by the same anti-tax, pro-small government movement that recently swept Toronto Mayor Rob Ford to power, said political scientist David Docherty, a professor at Wilfrid Laurier University. Mr. Docherty said there are some issues specific to Mr. McGuinty's team that have also particularly hurt his image, especially the exodus of high-profile cabinet members. It wasn't long ago Mr. McGuinty was surrounded by household names like former ministers Michael Bryant, George Smitherman, and Greg Sabara. But they've left Mr. McGuinty as the focal point for voter unrest. Mr. Docherty said he needs an initiative where people say, yes, this is a government that thinks strongly about education. If this election is about the HST and leadership, he's in trouble. That in the Globe and Mail by Greg MacArthur. Another brief break before we conclude the news. J.W. Jones. Tickets on yourself.
Well, you're talking all the time just to hear your voice. Rolling our eyes because we got no choice. You got tickets, baby. You got tickets, baby. You got tickets, baby. On yourself. Tickets, baby. You got tickets, baby. On yourself.
deadly legacy. Is Plastimet killing firefighters? The deaths occurred with stunning swiftness. First Vinny in September, then Len in October. In November, Larry. Beginning of January, Dave. 2 weeks ago, Joe almost joined them. It was only because his brother firefighters were on the ice playing hockey with him that he survived. Each was a Hamilton firefighter on active duty. Each was a non-smoker and extremely fit. The oldest was only 52. There is another common tie that binds most of them. Len, Larry, Dave, and Joe all fought one of North America's worst ever industrial fires, Plastimet. Joe Elliott admits he was lucky. At only 47, Elliott was in premier shape. I don't drink, I don't smoke, my wife and I eat healthy, and we work out at the gym all the time. We regularly do the escarpment stairs. Late last month, Elliott was on the ice playing hockey in the little 11-team Hamilton Firefighter League. I just didn't feel right. I'd come off the ice and feel dizzy, but I just kept shaking it off. The third time back to the bench, Elliott turned to tell a colleague something was wrong and collapsed. He stopped breathing and his teammates started CPR. He made it to hospital where doctors performed open-heart surgery to repair a malfunctioning aortic valve. The union says firefighters don't like talking about Plastimet because it makes them think about things they'd rather not think about. Some deal with it by fatalistically putting it out of their minds and getting on with the job. Some guys, though, it plays on their minds. Some just can't shake it, Elliott said. Post-Plastimet, Elliott decided he was worried enough about its effects that he asked his family physician to do a full physical. A heart murmur was detected, but it was deemed not to impair him in any way. Now recovering from open-heart surgery to repair the aortic valve, Elliott said his surgeon told him the valve's deterioration happened much quicker than it should have. The fire department is already in discussions with the union about expanding Hamilton's occupational health evaluation program to include heart monitoring. We're certainly concerned, said Acting Fire Chief David Cunliffe. Anytime there's a death, we're all concerned. It hits home. We haven't had any medical evidence provided at this point that links them to any specific event, but obviously we have concerns. And that by Paul Morse in The Spectator, Monday, Valentine's Day. Tories accused of digging up dirt on Liberal profs. Ottawa. Two University of Ottawa professors, vocal critics of the federal Conservative government, say they've become targets of a new political intimidation tactic aimed at using their private personal information against them. Professors Errol Mendes and Amir Adaran, frequently castigated as Liberal sympathizers by the Conservatives, were notified in recent weeks of two unusually massive Freedom of Information requests at the University of Ottawa, demanding details of the professor's employment, expenses, and teaching records. The person or persons behind the Freedom of Information requests remains anonymous under Ontario law. Heather McIver, a professor at the University of Windsor and a longtime researcher and commentator on the Conservative Party, said she believes that there is a concerted effort to put a chill on academic critics of the Harper government, especially from the hard right partisans who appear to see campuses as hotbeds of left-wing dissent. Last year, at a conference of the Manning Institute, founded by the leader of the Old Reform Party, Harper's former communications director, Corey Tanik, told a student, if you have a teacher or examples of teachers who are trying to jam lefty philosophy down your throat, please send me an email. I'd love to make them famous. McIver said she's been told that conservative operatives refer to her as a liberal hack. Her detractors appear to have drawn the conclusion because of a brief stint of employment as a researcher with the Liberal caucus back in the 80s when she was fresh out of university. Here's the thing. I don't make that public. I don't talk about the fact that I work for the Liberals, McIver said. I can tell you that my employment record for Parliament Hill is only in the National Archives. It takes a lot of work to find it. Somebody found it. And that by Susan Delacorte and Bruce Campion Smith in the Ottawa Bureau of the Toronto Star. Staff file claims against Chair of Human Rights. Recent staff departures and internal turmoil, including harassment complaints against Chairwoman Shirish Chotalia, are paralyzing the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal lawyer's charge. It's a complete mess right now, human rights lawyer Paul Champ told the Ottawa Citizen. The entire human rights system is in gridlock. It's in crisis. More than half the tribunal staff has left for other public service jobs or has been sidelined by stress since the appointment of Mrs. Chotalia, an Alberta lawyer named to the post by the Harper government in late 2009. According to the Public Service Alliance of Canada, five employees, roughly a quarter of the staff, have filed harassment-related complaints against Mrs. Chotalia. The tribunal acts as a court to rule on human rights cases referred to it by the Canadian Human Rights Commission. The Harper government has not renewed contracts of experienced tribunal members and has been slow to appoint new ones. For a brief period last year, Mrs. Chotalia was the only full-time tribunal member. At present, there are three full-time members, including Ms. Chotalia, and three part-time members, less than half the usual complement available to hear cases. And that in the National Post by Chris Cobb. And the good news story for this week, unexpected moral win for transgender, transsexual Canadians. Once again, the House of Commons has passed legislation against the will of Prime Minister Stephen Harper, this time to protect the rights of transgender and transsexual citizens. Once again, it's likely to die in the Senate. MPs from all parties, including Conservatives, rallied behind Bill C-389, which passed third reading on Wednesday night by the narrow vote of 143 to 135. While Mr. Harper and most of the Conservative caucus voted against the bill, six Conservatives stood to support it, including House Leader John Baird, Foreign Minister Lawrence Cannon, and Heritage Minister James Moore. The NDP and Bloc Québécois supported the bill unanimously, but several Liberals opposed it. Debate is likely to be short-circuited in any case, since the legislation has little chance of making it through the Senate. The Conservatives, who have a majority in the upper House, have adopted the tactic of using the Senate to block private members' bills passed by the House of Commons that don't accord with the government's agenda. Even if the bill does progress through the Senate, a spring election over the upcoming budget is becoming increasingly likely, which means that any legislation that isn't on the brink of royal assent is likely to perish. Those fighting to protect the rights of sexual minorities won a moral victory with the passage of 389 through the House. It may be the only victory they are able to enjoy. And that's all the news we have for this week at Disrespect. But come back next week. You know we will have more. We go out with a last tribute to the late Gary Moore. Died 2 weeks ago. The blues is all right.
Someone else left my heart in misery. Yes, you did. the blues was gonna be a part of me. This is why. You see, it's your last night, or with the blues, it was the last thing I thought I could use. Oh, but I'm glad that you left me, left me with the blues. That's right. If she hadn't given me the blues, I wouldn't find myself somewhere new. And I'm gonna tell you, I said, hey, hey, the blues is all right. Hey, hey, sing it. Blues is all right. Hey, hey, blues is all right. I said, hey, hey, blues is all right. It's all right.
All right.
All right.
All right.
Every day and night.
Every night.
Sing it for me one more time. I said, hey, hey, the blues is all right. Hey, hey, the blues is all right.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.